Hello, everybody. This is Paul Douglas Boyer. Welcome to the Mad Money Machine Show 131. We have some bad news to report from Asia this morning as Japanese banks are the latest to be hit. Apparently, Origami Bank has folded. Sumo Bank has gone belly up and Karaoke Bank is gone for a song. The Bonsai Bank is cutting back its branches while shares in Kamikaze Bank were suspended after they nosedived. Samurai Bank, following sharp cutbacks, is soldiering on, but Ninja Bank is reported to have taken a hit and they remain in the black. Furthermore, 500 staff at Karate Bank got the chop, and analysts report that there's something fishy going on at the Sushi Bank, where it's feared that staff may get a raw deal. Bad Money Machine. Show 131. 12 October 2008.
Mad Money Machine is brought to you by Index Funds Advisors at IFA.com. Helping investors succeed by matching people with portfolios.
Oh, that little bit of opening humor is brought to you by Karen DeKostner, relaying that on the LouRuckwell.com website from Manuel Klausner. I take credit for nothing there. In this show, we'll be talking about teetering on the edge of disaster and what we need to do about it. Oh, so retirement accounts, 401k accounts, have lost something north of $2 trillion so far this year, they tell me. According to the Dow Jones Wilshire 5000 Wealth Meter, the bear market has destroyed some $7.4 trillion in investor wealth. That's more than the combined annual GDPs of Japan and the United Kingdom. On the last show, I talked about how I had this feeling that the dollar is in this sort of deflationary, then inflationary tsunami. And it wasn't based on any fact that I pronounced that. Well, now I'm starting to hear from other legendary investors that they have the same feeling. For example, Jim Rogers. Let's listen.
Jim, what do we need from our G7 leaders this weekend?
Brother, what they need to do is, you know, go down to the bar and have a beer and leave the rest of us alone. Let the people who are sound succeed and let the other people fail. And you know, Jeff, what I'm afraid of is they're going to keep doing what they've been doing, which the market hates. You can see the market hates it, because this is going to unleash rampant inflation around the world, rampant confusion in the currency markets, and you're going to have people, currencies gyrating all over the world, bond markets are going to start to collapse, and then we're going to have a real problem. And that's why the stock market understands this. They're unleashing a inflationary holocaust because they don't know what else to do, and they're making mistakes.
I'm not quite sure if I understand this idea about inflation, hyperinflation. We seem to be in a deleveraging event, which is an amazingly fast deleveraging event, which is inherently deflationary.
Well, Adrian, when you print gigantic amounts of money and you flood the world with money, throughout history, that has led to inflation. Yet what I said was, we're coming out of this. They're setting the stage for when we come out of this, of a massive inflationary holocaust, was the word I used. That's what I meant. Right now, yes, everything is being liquidated. Everything is being liquidated. It doesn't matter about the fundamentals. But that's what I was explaining, too. In a period like this, the way you make money coming out of it is to own the things where the fundamentals have not been impaired.
And prior to that point, he had talked about how we should buy commodities, and I guess the Japanese yen and the Swiss franc were two of the currencies that he was looking to as safe havens. Now, Peter Schiff had this to say. He said, convinced that the bailout will actually work and that foreign governments are derelict for not launching similar plans, global investors are fleeing other currencies in favor of the dollar. Soon, investors will discover that foreign politicians and central bankers have acted responsibly. When they do, the current gains seen by the dollar will reverse violently. Now, we've seen some things in the news. The Italian leader had said that he expects that the world's markets will be closed for a few days or a week, and then he later retracted that statement. Several people are talking about a Bretton Woods 2 agreement that the G7 leaders may come to and try to reach. And this would be a new monetary system for the world. Bretton Woods, of course, was the original plan to have the dollar as the reserve currency of the world. What would they make as the reserve currency of the world post the dollar? Now, I've gotten a few emails from people asking me, how am I holding up? How are my investments doing? Was I buy and hold like I've been talking about so many times? Well, let me play a little clip for you, first of all, from show number 89 that I did back in last December. Let's get down to brass tacks today and talk a little bit about risk. You know, everything you read and hear today on TV and in the newspapers is about all this credit markets and the devaluing of the dollar. And what if there is a dollar crisis? How do we protect ourselves? So you know that risk capacity survey that you can take at IFA.com. Well, in there they ask you questions like, which one of the following is true? I could accept a 35% drop with a 12% annualized gain, or I could accept a 25% drop if I got a 10% annualized gain, and those kinds of questions. It's asking you quite literally, quite frankly, about your risk tolerance. And so when you look at it from the perspective of all the gains you can get, you might be tempted to say, yeah, I could accept a 35% drop if I was putting myself in a position to get 12% annualized gains. Well, think of it this way. Let's just make the statement. Let's just say this. Let's say that there's a chance that the United States will enter a deep recession within the next year or two, which might mean, and very well could mean, a 35% drop in the stock market. If you invested right now, would you still put everything in stocks, or would you diversify into bonds and suffer a smaller drop at the expense of lower long-term gains? And so look at where we are now. The Dow Jones, the S&P, the NASDAQ are something like 35 to 40% off of their highs of 1 year ago, a little bit after, a little bit before, actually. I recorded that show last December. Well, did I take my own advice? Yes, I did take my own advice. I talked about last year how we were moving out of my wife's 401k into an IRA plan. And when I did that, I didn't buy back into U.S. or foreign stocks. I bought back into other safer investments like bonds and some actual foreign currencies, which even those didn't work out very well. And my own 401k plan, sold everything, sold all the stocks, moved it into a bond fund, short-term bond fund. And I've done some calculations. Year to date, our net worth is down about 13%, but the savings that we have realized, I guess, from lowering our risk capacity earlier this year is about 23% from what it would have otherwise been had we just stayed at the same risk level. That's where I sit. Now, I've also made some dumb moves. For example, Southern Copper Corporation. I talked about how I only own three stocks, Berkshire Hathaway, Microsoft, and Southern Copper Corporation, and how it was up something like 160%, and I'm just going to hold on to it because it's so much fun watching it go up. Well, guess what? It is now all the way down negative below where I purchased it. And so I guess it doesn't make sense to buy and hold the individual stocks, certainly, but it went down so fast, I didn't even realize it. One of the other investments that I've had fun playing with, and I don't recommend this unless you can really spend a lot of time and keep your eye on it, but I did buy some of that Ultra Short Financials Fund and also the Ultra Short S&P 500 Fund. These are bear market funds. These are exchange-traded funds, and they go down, they go up 2 times the amount that those corresponding indexes go down. So, for example, the S&P Financials Index, when it goes down 1%, this ultra short financials index is supposed to go up 2%, and the same with that ultra short S&P 500 exchange traded fund. Ticker symbols SKF and SDS. Now me, the bonehead, I sold that the day the bailout was voted upon. I thought the bailout would might have some psychological impact on the market, and there was a risk to me that the stock markets would go up and rally from that point of the bailout. And dumb me, the person who takes absolutely no risk on his investments, if I would have just held a little bit longer, those funds are now up something like 60% since where I sold them. I got a good buddy that bought the SKF, though, and I think he owes me a dinner out for recommending that to him. Way to go, John. The VIX, the Volatility Index, which they call the fear gauge. Earlier this year, it was at 30, and people were talking about, whoa, the VIX is so high at 30. You know, you usually it's been down to 12 or 16 or 15 or something. This 30 really means the market is getting volatile. Well, a few weeks ago, it touched 40. People said, wow, 40, that's really high on the fear gauge. Then a few days later, it touched 50. And then a few days later, it touched 60. And now it's at an all-time high. It touched 74. The fear gauge is at 74. I actually don't make any decisions whatsoever about the about my investments based upon the VIX, though. Because to me, the VIX is just measuring something that's already happened. It's like looking at a thermometer and saying, it's hot outside, it's hot outside. I mentioned earlier Peter Schiff, and I had talked about how, at least I blogged it at badmetamachine.com, how his radio show, you have to kind of download it, and then you have to kind of import it into iTunes. Well, he must have been listening, because within that week, he has now made his radio show available as a podcast. And you can get it by going to europack.net, clicking on the blah, 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 the resources tab, the radio link. You can click in there to say, subscribe to this show in iTunes. Oh, it's a whole lot more convenient doing it that way. Thanks a lot, Peter Schiff, for doing that for us. There is a book that I started reading earlier this year, and I never did really get past the midway through point. The book is called Patriots, Surviving the Coming Collapse, a novel of the turbulent near future. And it's by James Wesley, Rawls. And I don't know why he has a comma in his name, but he is the author of survivalblog.com, which I've mentioned before. And here are some interesting things that he mentions in the very first chapter of this fictional book. When the credit crunch came, it did not arrive without warning. Now, this book is written in 2006, by the way. By the turn of the century, federal spending was out of control and the debt and deficit problems were insurmountable. And I'm going to say dot, dot, dot here and continue on a few paragraphs later. In Europe, international bankers began to vocally express their doubts that the U.S. government could continue to make its interest payments on the burgeoning debt. In mid-August, the chairman of the Deutsche Bundesbank made some off-the-record comments to a reporter from The Economist magazine. Within hours, his words flashed around the world via the internet. A full-scale default on U.S. treasuries appears imminent. He had spoken the dreaded D word. His choice of the word imminent in conjunction with the word default caused the value of the dollar to plummet on the international currency exchanges the next day. T-bills sales crashed simultaneously, starting with the Japanese foreign central banks and international monetary authorities began to dump their trillions of dollars in U.S. treasuries. None of them wanted the now risky T-bills or U.S. bonds. Within days, long-term U.S. Treasury paper was selling at 20 cents on the dollar. He continues a paragraph later. To help finance the ever-growing debt, the Federal Reserve decided to make a tactical move. It began monetizing larger and larger portions of the debt. The Fed already owned $462 billion in Treasury debt, which was considered an asset for the purposes of expanding the money supply. In a few days, the Federal Reserve holdings in Treasury debt more than doubled. The printing presses were running around the clock printing currency. The official domestic inflation rate jumped to 16% in the third week of August. To the dismay of the Fed, the economy refused to bounce back. A few paragraphs later, he writes, the catalyst for the real panic, however, was the stock market crash that started in early October. The bull stock market had gone on years longer than expected, defying the traditional business cycle. Nearly everyone thought that they were riding an unstoppable bull. From 15 to 20 billion in new mutual fund money had been pouring into the stock market every month. The market seemed to climb to unrealistic heights, driven by unmitigated greed. Soon after the dollar's collapse, however, the stock market was driven by fear. Unlike the previous crashes, this time the U.S. markets slumped gradually. This was due to circuit breaker regulations on the program trading implemented after the 1987 Wall Street slump. Instead of dropping precipitously in the course of one day as it had in 87, this time it took 19 days to drop 7,550 points. This made the dot-com bubble burst in 2000 look insignificant. Nobody could believe it. None of the market experts thought that the market could go down that far, but it did. Only a few contrarian analysts predicted it. Finally, the government suspended all trading since there was almost no one buying any of the issues that came up for sale. Because all the world's equities markets were tied inextricably together, they crashed simultaneously. The London and Tokyo markets were hit worse than the U.S. stock exchanges. The London market closed 5 days after the slump started. The quiet run on U.S. banks and the dollar had begun a month earlier. It took the GDP, the generally dumb public in America, that long to realize the party was over. The only investors that made profits in the crunch were those that had invested in precious metals. Gold soared to $5,100 an ounce, with the other precious metals rising correspondingly. Even for those investors, the gains were only illusory paper profits. Anyone who was foolish enough to cash out of gold and into dollars after the run-up in prices would have soon lost everything. This was because the domestic value of the dollar collapsed completely just a few weeks later. A few paragraphs later, he writes, with a superheated economy, there was no way for the government to check the soaring inflation aside from stopping the presses. This they could not do, however, because depositors were still flocking to the banks to withdraw all of their savings. One radio talk show host described the situation as watching a snake eat its own tail. Citizens on fixed incomes were wiped out financially by the hyperinflation within 2 weeks. Few could afford to buy a can of beans when it cost $150. The riots started soon after inflation bolted past the 1,000% mark. A few pages later, he writes, by early November, there was almost continuous rioting and looting in every major city in the U.S. Due to the financial panic and rioting, the November election was postponed to January, but it never took place. Rioting grew so commonplace that riot locations were read off in a list, much like traffic reports by news broadcasters. And then the book goes on to describe how all of this chaos closed down the transportation grids, trucks, trains, automobiles, and things just spiraled out of control from there. And very quickly in the book, then we get to the retreat location somewhere out in Idaho with the people who had prepared for survival. Well, if you're interested in seeing how the story ends, pick up a copy of Patriots Surviving The Coming Collapse by James Wesley Rawls, Rawles. The FDIC bank fail count is 15. Let's play a round of the world's favorite game, Guru Roulette. I've replaced the numbers on a roulette wheel with the names of investment gurus. I'll spin the wheel and roll the marble. And for the selected guru, give you a little background on their investment philosophy. So here we go. And the winner this time on Mad Men Machine Show 131 is George Soros. George Soros was born in Budapest, Hungary in 1930. His father was taken prisoner during World War I and eventually fled from captivity in Russia to reunite with his family in Budapest. Soros was 13 years old when Hitler seized Germany and began deporting the country's Jews to extermination camps. In 1946, as the Soviet Union was taking control of the country, Soros attended a conference in the West and defected. He immigrated in 1947 to England, supported himself by working as a railroad porter and a restaurant waiter, graduated in 1952 from the London School of Economics, and obtained an entry-level position with an investment bank. And in 1973, he set up a private investment firm that eventually evolved into the Quantum Fund, one of the first hedge funds through which he accumulated a vast fortune. And he's written a number of books, and he appeared in an interview with Bill Moyers And here's what he said.
You use the word disaster.
The financial system is teetering on the edge of disaster. Hopefully, it will not go over the brink, because it very rarely does. It only did in the 1930s. Since then, whenever you had a financial crisis, you were able to resolve it. This is the most serious one since the 1930s. There hasn't been one as serious as this. Unfortunately, the authorities are behind the curve. They are reacting to these crises as they emerge. One thing leads to another. One market after another gets into difficulty, and they react to it. And they don't quite understand what's hitting them. So they are not anticipating and not gaining control of the situation.
Now, wait just a minute here. What did he say again?
The financial system is teetering on the edge of disaster. Hopefully, it will not go over the brink.
Teetering on the edge of disaster. Hopefully, it won't go over the edge. This is a guy with $1 billion, and he is hoping that we won't go into financial disaster. Now, no one has asked the question of any of these guys that say, oh, we might have a financial disaster, we might have a financial disaster, we're teetering on the edge. No one has asked the question, what happens in a financial disaster? What should we do to prepare ourselves if financial disaster were to happen? How can we avoid the risks? Now, a lot of gold bugs, I must say, are saying that the thing to do is buy gold and avoid the hyperinflation run-up. Is that the answer here, George Soros? Is that what you would do? Would you buy gold? What would you do with your billions of dollars? Something else you should know about George Soros. I'd like for you to go to a website called obamamessiah.blogspot.com. And the second picture that appears there, Obama's giving a speech on some stairs leading up. It looks like in a very fancy house or apartment or Manhattan flat somewhere. And just seated to his right, in blue, is George Soros. Oh, and another funny thing was on Saturday Night Live, I think last Saturday, they did a little skit and they kind of lampooned George Soros. They put that video on the internet, but later it was taken down, it appears, although you can still find it. If the MadMoneyMachine.com website is taken down, you'll know why. Congratulations, George Soros, you're the guru on Mad Money Machine Show 131. Well, with all this talk of economic collapse and stock market collapse, I think we need to take a pause, reflect a little bit, and listen to the wise words of Mark Hebner from Index Funds Advisors. He has taken a scientific look at the markets, including markets all the way back to 1928, pre-Great Depression, and in the Learning Earnings segment, where we learn how to earn our financial freedom. Let's listen to the wise words of Mark Hebner on the resilience of capitalism. This is from his website at ifa.com. He says, in the light of the very challenging investment markets over these last few weeks, I would like to offer some much-needed perspectives. I'm sympathetic to your concerns and want to help you through this difficult time in the stock market. Many investors may find themselves questioning their ability to remain in their investments right now. If you're concerned, the first step is to review and take into consideration the proper time horizon for your investments. If your time horizon or liquidity needs have changed from the last time you took the risk capacity survey, you should take the survey again to determine if an adjustment in your index portfolio, your risk exposure, is necessary at this time. If you are at a point in time when you are routinely withdrawing funds from your portfolio, we recommend that you not withdraw more than 7% of your portfolio value per year, with a 5% withdrawal being optimal. When markets have declined, you should reduce your withdrawals to as low as you can stand In other words, cover your fixed costs and reduce your variable costs. As a general rule of thumb, the equity allocation of your portfolio should have an approximate time horizon or holding period of 7 to 10 years. This would indicate that you should have an allocation of fixed income that will meet your withdrawal needs for approximately 5 years. So if you're withdrawing 5% per year, you should have at least 25% of your portfolio in fixed income. Our risk capacity survey is the best method to determine your asset allocation because it considers all 5 dimensions of your risk capacity, of which time horizon is the most important, but not the only factor. Now, this entire article is available at IFA.com, and I encourage you to read the whole thing. I'm not going to take the time right now to read the entire thing, but let me skip down to where he quotes the IFA investment policy statement. He says, a properly constructed investment policy statement provides support for the investment manager to follow a well-conceived long-term investment discipline rather than one that is based on constant revisions brought on by lack of knowledge, overconfidence, or panic in reaction to short-term market movements. The absence of a written policy statement reduces decision-making to an individual event basis and often leads to chasing short-term results that detracts from achieving long-term market rates of returns. The existence of a written and agreed-upon policy encourages all parties to maintain their focus on the long-term nature of the investment process, especially during the extreme fluctuations in stock market returns. In the last paragraph, I'll skip all the way down, he says, when the markets abruptly turn around, investors who bought and held risk-appropriate portfolios of low-cost, passively managed index funds will be in a position to benefit from the market's reaction to the unexpected news events that will once again show the resilience of capitalism. And that's the title of his article. In the meantime, as long as you invest according to your risk capacity and keep your eyes fixed on your time horizon, you should do your best to ignore the media, yeah, like Mad Money Machine, and spend your time on the things in your life that you enjoy. Learning, Earning, brought to you by Index Funds Advisors. I want to thank you so very much for joining me. This is Paul Douglas Boyer saying it takes money to make money, and it takes teetering on the edge of disaster to make a Mad Money Machine. I'll see you in a week. In the meantime, go visit Index Funds Advisors at IFA.com and take again their risk capacity survey. I appreciate your feedback emailed to me, feedback@madmoneymachine.com, or even better, call the voicemail line, 206-734-4763. Get my market updates at twitter.com/madmoneymachine or visit the website madmoneymachine.com. I'll see you in a week.